What we don't know how to do is to be with each other in a way that invites authenticity. We demand it, and you're never going to get it through demanding it. You're going to get it through creating the right atmosphere with someone that encourages them to be vulnerable and open with you.
Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I just came from a conference, the big Florida State Conference. There's a hurricane coming, and I'm just sort of negotiating my way back to Toronto. I don't want to get stuck. Like, there's no direct flight from here, so I could fly into Charlotte and be stuck there for 3 days. So there's already been some havoc. I understand Philadelphia had some trouble, and D.C. Shut down a bunch of flights.
I was in a hurricane once when I was on the road, and I can't remember the city, but it was the best. I loved doing it because I didn't have to worry about anything I owned, any people I loved. It's like, yeah. I just got to sit in that hotel, actually on the front porch of the hotel with my new friends there, because we lost all our electricity, and we just watched the fucking rain go sideways and trees bend and all this stuff. And I'd never done it without being scared shitless that something was going to get damaged or somebody was going to get hurt.
You brought up the consciousness being multiple just now, and I was actually explaining that concept to somebody else yesterday, and it's really like, it's a great, I don't know, notion, because I was just using it to describe how I'm like working with somebody who's struggling with recovery. And I was using it to describe to someone how I've sat down with that person in their rational mind, in their sober mind. They've been humble, you know, they've been reasonable, and kind of like in touch with like how some of their isms, you know, have kind of dragged them, you know, to and fro and caused a lot of chaos. And then recently I've been in conversation with the sick person, with the victim mentality, sends angry texts at weird hours of the night and is just kind of suffering, you know what I mean? And it's a reminder that those people, those consciousnesses are in play always. Sometimes one goes and sits down for a little bit and taps out, but you got to be mindful because they're always kind of jockeying for their time in the spotlight. And anyway, well,
sometimes they're very split, like you're saying. I mean, we all have that back and forth in our head, but yeah, you get people who are really struggling, and it's like, no, they really get, they're split. It's two different folks you're hearing from. I've had clients like that. I don't ever know who's coming to the session.
And I've been that. I'm laying this out. I'm not excluding myself from that continuum. Yeah. So.
All right. I'll be ready for the late night text.
Yeah. I'll send them. I'll put it in the group, guys.
Yeah. We appreciate that.
We're going to talk about bringing emotional sobriety into situations and contexts where there's very little to no consciousness or existence of it, maybe. And, you know, how does we broaden the circle from 12-step groups and fellowships and emotional sobriety groups and fellowships into the quote-unquote real world?
This exists and this happens and it's measurable. Just for the record, if people didn't hear the pre-show stuff, Tom is already up 1,000 points in our little Jeopardy round on another big chill quiz. But what percentage of people in general do you think give back to charity, community, you know, some sort of helping engagement with their money and or their time? Okay, 17?
I was going to say 25.
25? And Patrick?
5%.
Okay, so it's 40. So,
Wow.
I'm happy 40%. About that.
Yeah, that is very good.
I really like that. I was really afraid that Patrick had nailed it.
That's right. That's right. Things are so bad, and that there's no time for that kind of pessimism, Tom. Now, and what?
Kevin Costner.
And this is okay. There's your 1,000 points secure. At what percentage of people in recovery, and this is taken from life in recovery surveys that have been done in the United States of America, in the UK, in Canada, and in Australia. And they asked, you know, besides your sort of recovery, what type of other community service do you do? And what percentage of people in recovery do you think give back?
80%.
Exactly. Really? That is exactly right.
Well, think about that. But think about what that says for our community. Twice as many.
That's right. Wow. And that's emotional sobriety. That's we're, you know, getting to the point where we're beyond ingrown eyeballs and just concerned about ourselves. And we're sort of, you know, we're emotionally stable. We're emotionally sober. We're able to sort of, like, you know, go into the community and contribute something positive, and on
we're busy, like you were doing earlier today. We're busy getting sandbags ready for the hurricane, right?
We
pitch in, we help.
That's exactly right, and that is baked into something. I don't know what it is, and it's true beyond 12-step communities, but all sort of recovery, all people in recovery from, you know, different peer-to-peer groups or people who have done it through therapy or, you know, their own sort of self-help type thing. We see this community engagement going from, so it's a post-traumatic gain. You know, they went from, you know, being complete parasites, and I'm speaking for myself as an example here, of just using, and depleting resources, to somebody who, you know, really thinks about what does the world need? What are my strengths? What am I good at? And how can I use that to fulfill some need the world needs? So that would be an interesting way to look at emotional sobriety in terms of how that the affect of that when we sort of go out into the community, right? Because I see it all the time.
But you don't start at that place either. I mean, the idea you go about in the 80s and 90s, I began to get really scared that everything about recovery was just going to be about me, and you know, and actually with hindsight, it's just, we were going through it, man. That's the phase we were going through. We noticed it, we talked about it, we plugged back in.
Yeah.
Or plugged in for the first time.
Sometimes. That's right.
You have to go in and you have to go in the cocoon and take care of yourself. And then, but when you emerge, we emerge a better person.
That's a good metaphor.
Say that again, Alan.
I said, that's a good metaphor. You know, it's funny that you start with this, Joe, because lately I've been really aware of how the tendency is to focus on who we're not who we are. And who we are in general, like you're saying, is someone we want to cooperate. We want to be of value. We want to be altruistic. We want to make a difference in this world in a positive way. Mm-hmm. But when, as Tom is saying, is that when we're really struggling, is it becomes all about us. And see, this is what you're underlining here. It's a very important part of emotional sobriety. It's not about us. Right. It's not about us in terms of, you know, the importance of not taking things personally, but also in terms of even a bigger picture, in terms of we're just one small piece of a whole thing that's unfolding in this world. And how do we want to be? What contribution do we want to make, however big or small that may be, to that unfolding of this of a new consciousness? Because that's what this is about. This is about, you know, it's counterculture, man. It's really counterculture. It goes against so much. Like this Christopher Lash wrote this great book. I don't know if you ever read it, Joe, but it was The Culture of Narcissism.
Oh, Jesus. I didn't know the author.
That book broke my heart.
Oh, my God.
It was so hard to read.
When he published that in the 70s, it was so controversial because you're coming out of, I mean, it was such a well thought out, you know, critique and an inventory, we could even say, mm-hmm. of what was going on in this culture. And as other great thinkers of that time, like Eric Fromm said, this is a culture of having, not of being. It's a culture of materialism, not of spirituality and wisdom. I mean, and that's a big, big issue. So when you say, God, 80%, see, that's the unfolding of a new consciousness.
Yeah, that's the healing. That's the healing. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, right, because that 80%, they've conflated their own survival and well-being with the survival and well-being of
the community,
the greater body, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to this more mercenary attitude that we're urged towards in, you know, in the culture and
talk capitalism. About a great metaphor. Think about that. So think your body, some of these cells heal, but they don't share with the other cells. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, what happens if that happened to me during the last fall, I would die of cancer. It's like,
yeah.
It's that organic. It's it just keeps, it does that. We're not necessarily getting there just all by conscious choice. It's not all mapped out in a plan in the back war room. This is a natural path. This is nature.
And in terms of that sort of, let's call it the consumer culture, right? The narcissistic culture as being like I need stuff. I need more stuff. I need more space to put my stuff in. Addiction is the epitome or the end result of that sort of consumer culture, right? Just more, more, more. And we learn that the only way to get from out of that isolation of self is to share our problems with another, and then in very short order to help out another, right? And here we are, we see the community actually is the solution to our isolation, which any sort of narcissism or selfishness is going to create, and certainly addiction does. You know, I'm lying to myself. I'm lying to my loved ones. I have a secret life, and you know, you get this community where you can say anything and be accepted, and you see that the whole world needs that, and you take it out into the world. Yeah, I mean, it in essence, whether it's from a eightfold path, do the right living, or from a 12-step perspective of carrying the message, beyond our own household, it's baked into that recovery thing, and it's amazing to see that as I was thinking about that this week as a example of what emotional sobriety looks like.
I couldn't help but think about Alan when your son-in-law passed recently, and you had to speak at the funeral, and this was an event that was precipitated by addiction issues, and I imagine that you were among a lot of people attending, who maybe there were normies, or maybe there were people who weren't as intimately involved with that process and that suffering. You were able to contribute something of emotional sobriety, I think, to that group of people. Invaluable. One of your grandchildren told you that they were able to have some peace, right? About
My little grandson said this was the best day of his life, which was shocking after he's just hearing about his memories and celebration of his dad. And to me, I felt the sadness about it's this, Eric's no longer with us. But he said something very, very telling. He says, this is the first time I've heard so many people talk so positively about my father.
Yeah, it's profound.
It's, and out of the mouths of babes, right? I mean, we say that stuff all the time. But what he was saying is in general, even when a person's in the throe of their illness, we just look at that person as their illness. we forget there's a person in there. There's somebody in there that's trapped, that doesn't know how to get out. And that's why I, you know, have such a hard time when somebody's in treatment and they get blamed for their disease instead of helping it when they relapse. I mean, it's so sad that our consciousness hasn't evolved to the point of being able to see beyond what a person's doing to who a person is.
That's so true. I remember being called out in adult children of alcoholics as, Joe, you're not a human being, you're a human doing.
There it is.
And what they were calling out was that my only value came from what I thought I did or had, as opposed to like a title, you know, something on a business card, you know, whatever it is, a song, an article, you know, something, you know, I had some value because of something I did, as opposed to I inherently have value because I'm an earthling, you know,
absolutely.
I deserve to be here.
Well, in terms of the transformation of that, it reminds me of a friend of mine who died a few years ago. I borrow this when I have an opportunity, when I'm quick enough to catch it. When somebody would ask him, and he was a recovering person, but I don't know that he ever associated this with his recovery. When somebody would ask him, "What do you do?" he would say, "About what?"
Good, and just stop.
He would just wait. He had hit the tennis ball back over the net. Yeah, the person had to come up. You know, it was like they were just speechless. It was hilarious to watch.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I grew up in Montreal, Quebec, which is kind of a very sort of European-ish type of culture. And then moved out west, which was a very different culture. And then I moved to Toronto, only, you know, a 6-hour drive from Montreal, not far apart, but completely diametrically opposed in terms of the culture, very business oriented. And I used to always tell people that Toronto is a thank God it's Monday town, because everybody associates themselves with what they do, right? Oh. And in Toronto, you ask, what do you do? It's a question people expect and they're ready for, and they talk about their job. But you ask that same question to someone in British Columbia on the West Coast or in Quebec, I'm a sailor, I'm a painter, right? I'm a father, I'm a, you know, a guitar player, you know.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They talk about what they love as opposed to,
yeah, that's cool. How
it would be a better world.
Wow, that's a great, the four of us could try to change this socially and just see what we can do. Instead of asking people what they do, ask them what they love.
Yeah.
You know, what do you love about your life? You know?
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I was channeling you guys the other day the good parts, when I was talking to a friend of mine whose mother is passing away from cancer, and he is having this like wrenching experience of figuring out how he can get to her, or if he should get to her by flight, you know, towards the end. And it's he has a very complicated relationship with his mom, and there's a lot of factors restraining him, I suppose, from just being able to like impulsively jump on that flight and do that thing. And so it's on the table, certainly, that, you know, he might not make that trip. You know what I mean? It might be too late. And if I'm really in touch with what matters to me and what matters to the situation, and like Alan said, last week, having relationships appropriate to those relationships, I want to kind of Socratically ask him, you know, what's important to you about this? And, you know, like remove from my judgment or anybody else's judgment that might be blowing up your phone right now and telling you what you ought to do and what's the proper thing, you know, when you reach the when your parents reaching the end of your life, and you got to think about kind of like, how am I going to show up? You know, like I don't know. I on my committee, I felt the judging voice jumping up and kind of like telling me all these things that I should, you know, urge him towards, or, you know, kind of try to manipulate or control the situation. But maybe, like, without getting too into the weeds, like the emotionally sober tack to take is to not try to control the situation and to be present and to kind of like, you know, as non-judgmentally as possible, just kind of, you know,
wow,
put him in touch, but try to put him in touch with, you know, what he's feeling and what he may, what may be most vital to him about that dynamic.
Wow.
And so I hope I did okay, you know, but that was, it was a hard conversation.
You set me up perfectly with what I didn't think I was going to find a way to do this, but I have this really brief quotation from Ernest Hemingway I was reading this morning. Hemingway gives advice to writers, but you know, it's bigger than that. It says, listen now, when people talk, listen completely. Don't be thinking what you're going to say. Most people never listen, nor do they observe. You should be able to go into a room, and when you come out, know everything that you saw there, and not only that, and it goes on after that. But it was like, open up. What you did in your intrapersonal landscape, Patrick, was you basically just put your hand out and held the judge back. He can judge all he wants. He didn't get to the microphone. You don't get to speak in this meeting. And beautiful.
What does the judge have to do with that? You know what I mean? Like, that's, I think, what was occurring to me when I was having that conversation is that, you know, the judge has no, I don't know what like positive effect the judge would have in that a conversation like that with a dear friend, you know?
Yeah.
From one of my, and that judginess can be really a hindrance to the therapeutic process too, when you're trying to sort of self-discovery, you know, just, the judge has to sort of sit back and have a somatic or emotional experience as opposed to a critical thinking experience all the time. Tom said something about, you know, how we greet people instead of asking them what we do. At the first of this month, William Schaberg wrote or published a brand new book. He's written a number of things that have been, you know, very research intensive, very historical. This one's more a legacy book. It's called 30 Things, Practical Advice for Living Well. And it's just through his life, you know, his struggles, the people who have helped him out, how he resisted these things that turned out to be exactly what he needed and working through it. And there's 30 of them. And one of them is a antidote to these sort of superficial conversations, you know, our job as our identity. And it's to start a conversation with, so what has become clear to you since the last time we met?
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I put myself in that as a role play. And you said that I immediately go inside and I come back out quickly because I'm in a conversation and I say, apparently nothing. It's a mess in there. It's a challenge. That's a great question. If you say that, I'm going to leave with that question. That question is coming with me. We say this all the time, Alan, don't you in therapy say, you know, getting the questions right are so much more important than there's no one answer. Questions are like magnets. They'll draw information. And what is becoming clear is a beautiful.
Well, you were talking, Tom, about how you weren't quite sure how to approach this topic. And then you came across this great Ernest Hemingway quote, right, about having a curious mind and positive regard and sort of, you know, trying to be a student instead of knowing it all. I mean, that is exactly what we're talking about here, right? You know, that's a better way to look at life than I got this, I know this.
No kidding. No.
I know it's going to happen here type of approach to life.
You know,
I just say real quickly that we've talked about this on the podcast before, but if we traveled back in time and told a younger version of myself that try to describe this, the idea that not only is it okay for me to not know something or to be confused by something, not get it, it's like I can say it out loud, and it's not only I don't feel bad, I feel good about myself. Because I'm able to do that, because that's strength, you know. I don't have to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What a freedom, right? You know, a very, very important friend of mine said to me, Joe, you seem to think you need to know what to say. You seem to think you need to know what to do. Your job is to show up, Joe. That's your job. Show up.
Nice. Such a liberation.
Yeah.
I'm glad that I noticed now that the part of me that's always wanted to jump out and say things rather than to listen, you know, I may not always win that battle, right? I may not always win it, but like in noticing that I feel a lot better when I can be a receptor rather than trying to kind of always impose something onto what's happening. That's another way of saying trying to control everything that's happening. It does feel better. I don't know. I feel much more a part of when I can just actually be the receptor.
Yeah. And it goes back to Alan's, we need to learn to be ourselves, right? And if what someone needs from me is not for me to have all the answers, but for me to show up and be present, you know, all I'm asked is to be myself.
We're talking about conversations that are several layers deeper than most have in a day-to-day world. It's like, and you know, I think this is worth exploring more in on the podcast. And is the idea of, because what's the problem of the world? And I'm not asking to get into content politically, but religion and politics, everything. What's the problem? Communication sucks.
Yeah.
Everybody polarizes. Nobody actually communicates. There's never enough time to get to know the other person. It's like, if we could talk about getting down into that, and I think it's for uncomfortable place. And sometimes it's uncomfortable because I'm afraid somebody else is going to take it at a surface level and just take off with the conversation, you know, but I would rather talk about, you know, understanding each other.
Yeah.
You know, the most powerful quality in terms of that interplay, and we were talking about it a little bit last week with the politics and in Carol, patience, yeah. the tortoise and the hare. Yep. You know, like I find that the people that change my mind, and I think the those rare instances where I've changed another person's mind has not come from me battering my point, you know, against their point over and over until my hands are bloody. It's in staying with them and just kind of like just a tenacious and patient and compassionate game of just waiting, you know, until a point is reached and there's no setting a clock to when that point will be reached, where, you know, the minds and the hearts can meet. Right. But like, it's only through patience that anything can be brokered in something like
one
that.
One of my little nutshells I have on the wall at my office is one of my favorites. It's respect is not necessarily expressed through agreement. And so often we mean, I respect that person. It means I like the way he thinks. I think like he does or she does. It's like no. When we're talking about being receptive and listening to somebody, even somebody that I vehemently disagree with, I'm being respectful. Because all that means is I get it. You're a separate individual, separate human being, separate story, separate history. You're not me.
Mm-hmm. What are examples of where we can bring a consciousness of emotional sobriety to a situation where there's none? And see, what you're talking about, Tom, I think is a great place to start. You know, let's say somebody starts criticizing you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that? You just shut them down, you polarize with them and say, look, you're toxic, I don't want anything to do with you. Or see, and this is where, you know, going back to what Joe was saying about being in a community, we are our brother's keeper. Meaning if Joe is coming to me and saying, you know, Al, you're full of shit. I'm pissed off at you. Da, 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 da. If I make it about me, then I'm going to get defensive. Probably my style is to attack back and say, well, when you're fucking talking about me, Joe, let me tell you a few things about you. I mean, you know, I got the Southern European style. The Northern European style says, oh, you're right, Joe. I'm a piece of shit. And you just go and you turn it all on yourself. But the other way is to turn it on the other person. But listen, it's the same issue, is that you're not dealing with what's happening between you and the other person. But see, if we are a brother's keeper, then saying something like, wow, there must be a lot going on for you to be that angry and that critical of me. Can you tell me how I disappointed you? I want to know what's underneath all of that. You see, what we don't know how to do is to be with each other in a way that invites authenticity. We demand it, and you're never going to get it through demanding it. You're going to get it through creating the right atmosphere with someone that encourages them to be vulnerable and open with you.
Okay.
And that's not an easy thing, man. I'm telling you, nobody wants to start with that. It will start with, you know, I'm going to tell you, you know, all the things you did wrong, because I don't want to open up how disappointed I am and in the pain I'm feeling. So I'm going to go ahead and project that onto you. But see, the thing we can do, you know, starting with what Patrick is saying, and I was leading to it before, is to look beyond what a person's saying to what a person's experiencing. I'll say it again. We got to look beyond the content and look at who that person is and what in the world would make someone come to you that way. See, that's the thing that not many people have the skill to do, because they say, oh my God, how dare you talk to me that way? And you get all righteous about it and say, you know, you must not really like me if you're, or respect me if you're talking to me that way. You know, I think it's the opposite. If somebody's got the mind to start to talk to you, it means that they're trying to connect with you, albeit that they're doing it in a spastic way. They're knocking a glass of water off the table instead of keeping it on. I'm not in any way whitewashing that behavior. That person needs to look at how they're communicating their pain and stuff like that. There's no question. That's an important part of this. But when someone can't,
do
we just condemn them? Or do we invite them?
Okay. There's another step. You skipped a step, so I want to talk about that in a minute.
What's the step?
The step is looking at yourself. It's like the idea the story we're telling here, that we're actually making an assumption that the person who confronts us is wrong in some way, doing it, maybe wrong in content, maybe just wrong in how they're doing it. But the first step to me, when you say somebody criticizes me, what's the first thing I do? I'd look and see if there's parts of either all of it or part of it is true. Because the idea of just reflecting back on them is not the place to start, but
that's not what I'm saying. See, when I say to look at what they're doing, is they may be disappointed with something I did, and when I'm talking, I'm not excluding. So what I'm saying is to get them to say it to us in a way that reveals what the injury is.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just coming to me and getting angry about something, right, they're not really talking about the pain of their disappointment. And yes, you know, I will at that point in time, and that's why we're creating this atmosphere, is to create an atmosphere of mutual vulnerability. But see, that you're right. It might also go to say, hey, let me look at this. But when I see what's really going on in another person, you see what I mean? It creates a certain atmosphere, Tom, that yes, what you're saying is also important, is we got to look at our own culpability. But I'm taking a step way beyond that right now. I'm not looking at that. I'm just looking at how do we create an atmosphere with someone that invites someone to talk about what's really going on in their experience.
Right. See, we're not disagreeing. It's like you no. and I often have arguments in which we don't disagree. It's like, we've had some doozies actually.
Yes, yes, that's for sure.
I just think part of emotional sobriety is
so how would always, that sound? So how would that sound? So I told you how mine would sound. How would that sound if you were doing that? Let's say. Patrick saying, you know, goddamn, Tom, you're a fucking selfish bastard. You know, you're always fucking talking about yourself. I'm calling you to tell you about how my fucking partner is locking me in the room and you're telling me about, you know, your dog. Mm-hmm. Fuck you, man. What the fuck kind of friend are you? So now what's your response?
Okay. Well, this is getting complicated. Two kinds of scenarios. You're saying, how do you deal with somebody who's just kind of just over the top upset? Or how do you deal? We've got to keep in mind the person may be more reasonable who's talking to me about this and bringing the criticism.
But let's apply. You could apply what you just said to that. You could just say to Patrick, you know, man, you're right. I was selfish when we talked.
That's what I'm getting. It's like you don't.
You were saying that if he was more reasonable, you could do it. But I'm saying
no. That is not what I was saying.
You said over the top, right?
No. I was just commenting on the fact that every time you go back to your scenario, the person is unreasonable.
Said in that scenario, how would you deal with it? Just deal with that scenario. Create another one to talk about.
It's easy. I want more information. Tell me what, you know, I just interviewed.
I'm pissed at you. Last time we talked, all you did was talk about your dog and I was locked in this fucking room. You know, that's what you're talking about. That was fucking selfish. So now you're responsible.
Okay. I mean.
Yeah. Okay.
I get that. See, that's the thing. I get that. It's okay for him to be right. That I was being too more selfish.
Let me offer something. So it would be in Alan's version, you would say, wow, it sounds like you're having the experience of being very closeted in and very.
My version of that would be this, is that, wow, I can really see that from that experience we had together, that you conclude that I'm not really that interested in you and your experience.
Right.
And I must be failing in some way, letting you know how important you really are to me.
Okay, in my version of it, I don't sound like a therapist for one thing.
That's not a therapist. That's somebody being. See, we call being vulnerable.
That's vulnerable.
A therapist, Tom. That's not being a therapist. That's learning to talk in a different.
Therapist model how to be vulnerable. That's right. Absolutely. That's
right. Yeah, we can't fault that as therapy. Don't do that. Yeah. Then you're poisoning the well for people to talk that way. And you say, oh, fuck, I sound like a therapist. Well, the fucking world would be a lot better off if more people sounded like a fucking therapist, in my opinion. Jesus Christ, we might have learned how to get along with each other.
So we're doing it right now where you're saying that to me. I'm going like I hear what you're saying about poisoning the well by making that comment. What I can say is I don't agree with you. I don't think that necessarily does it. I think that's given that comment way more power than it should have. It's this is where it gets complicated because we could go into a conversation that says, okay, well, good question. That's also therapeutic. What do you mean by that? What sounds therapeutic that seems like it might be harmful? It's like, you know, I would say you start with an observation about the other person. It's like, you know, and I can think of other ways where I can might be able to respond and be able to own some of my own stuff earlier if it's my stuff. And most of the time, if somebody criticizes me, not most of the time, but a lot of the time, they do have a point. And it's okay for emotional sobriety to be that conversation can be that simple. Also, it doesn't have to go that
right.
It can be. Right. You're right. And I want to tell you, I'm going to do my best to do better than that. And, you know, and maybe I have the feedback that I think he's having a little bit of a crisis because his partner keeps him locked in that closet.
Right. Yeah. And so Alan is talking about, I think, being with the person in their experience first. And you're talking about identifying your part first.
Well done, Patrick. And I like what you said, Tom. You're right. If you just said, you know, God, you're right, man. That was selfish. And I can see that really it was important for me to hear what you were saying, man. I'm with you now. I'm not selfish right now. I'm hearing you. Tell me what's going on. See, that would be a repairing the situation, too. You're right.
Okay, where's that mute button?
The sad part is, how did I get in the middle between two fucking?
No. This is great because I am a Tom. I was talking about that, right? Like, or Northern European, as Alan described it, right? Like, I see someone's upset.
Yeah.
I take responsibility for it. I do my own inventory, but now I'm being that person who thinks I should know, I should have known better. I've identified the problem and I've got to fix it. I'm the fixer, instead of understanding what their experience of how I'm being or what I did is, in terms of, can you, you know, to paraphrase what Alan said, I can see you're upset. What was it I did that got you this way? I need to understand. I want to understand. And that's so much, takes so much less work. And, you know, like the sort of entire, you know, deck of the Enterprise to be engaged, right? You know, it's just you tell me. I'm a student. I come with the curiosity, not with know-how, right? And that seems like an easier way for me to communicate than my default reaction is, I should have known that. I've got to anticipate. Right. You know, it's what I did. I've got to own this. That I do that. Right. And
Well, it's and Alan's description of the Northern and Southern European is are the extremes, you know, which, you know, one is going to be a blamer. They're both blaming. I'm going to blame. One's going to, if I'm from the North, I'm blaming myself immediately. It's a reflex. If I'm from the South, I'm blaming you for doing that. And the other thing is, I realize here as we're talking, and this is just where I go, like, well, this is probably just me, you know, just being too detailed about language and stuff like that. But when you were giving your example there, I was going back to the example with Patrick, and it occurred to me, I didn't thought about this earlier, but the way he said what he was in this role play thing, the way he said what it was, I knew exactly what I did. I didn't need to say what is it you need to do. He actually communicated that very well. It was not only was I being selfish, but this is what he saw me doing. That was selfish. So it was really easy. The idea that I choose my dog over him, and I go like, "Oh shit, I do that."
Or the honest thing might be to say, "You know, my dog is more important than you at that time." And look, and that would be okay to say too. Is I realize I was more focused on that than you, man. But that doesn't mean I don't care about you. We can take responsibility without taking it on. That's a very nuanced here. And I just think it's important to say it. I can own that. I can say, God, you're right, man. I was talking to you all about my dog. My head was on there. And I hear that really bothered you. And I am sorry for that piece, but I want you to know I was more focused on my dog. But that doesn't mean from my side that I don't care about you, man, because I really do. So let's go back. What do you need to tell me about this? What are the coordinates? And I'll send out the SWAT rescue team over to your place to get you or whatever. But see, that's this important dialogue. See, this is what, when you hear me say something like stay connected and add more self, that's what that looks like. Mm-hmm. See, this whole dialogue we're going into now, Tom, between you and I, and this whole thing, you've been adding more yourself. I've been adding more myself. You didn't disappear and say, fuck Berger. He's fucking doing it again, that asshole. And then just fucking sign off the podcast.
Tom, you can read.
I think he signed off, Patrick. I think
you can read my notes from there.
This therapeutic mind. I can read. I can do the mind meld, the Vulcan mind meld, right on. Fuck, look, I'm doing it to Joe now. I'm doing the Vulcan mind meld.
That's right. You know, I think that's definitely. I mean, this is that place where we don't, you know, I always say don't have conversations to convince, have conversations to convey. And that's what we're sticking beautiful in there and working. And, you know, the thing that and I always tell couples, the thing we have to keep your defenses down, we have to keep your defenses down long enough for you to clarify things, because you're going to misunderstand each other on the front end. You're going to have to keep talking, like what you're talking about. I got to stay there.
And this is where I have a difference, right? So I don't think they need to keep the defenses down. Keep them up. Keep them up and deal with that. See, this is the requirement. We don't need people to be different than they are to have a good connection. We just need to deal with what's going on, whatever it is, and not put all these requirements and all these other demands on what it needs to look like. We can get to where what you're saying is where the defenses go down. That's all I'm saying. There is a way to have a defenseless experience, no question. And the value of that, like you know, Tom, and I know, is incredible. Because that's when intimacy occurs. That's when, what do we say? When I let into you, I let you see. Or into me, I let you see.
Intimacy,
right? And that's what this is about. You're right. So now, just in case anybody's out there worrying about Patrick, he is not malnourished. He is not being beaten. He's not in an abusive relationship. We're just talking about this. So don't worry about Patrick. He's fine. He looks well nourished. How is your leg recovering, Patrick?
Thanks so much for asking. It's honestly a little better every day. And I may be in a storage room that looks like absolute chaos, but I cannot be happier just being on the pod with you guys and really getting into the nitty gritty of, you know, where the rubber meets the road with emotional sobriety.
Yeah. You know, I've been struggling. Last time on the podcast, I was clearly so fatigued, man.
You were wiped out, man.
I'll tell you, Tom, is that for the last, God, I don't know how long it's been now, maybe 3 months, maybe longer, something happened with the surgery and my peripheral neuropathy. I've got peripheral neuropathy from Agent Orange in Vietnam. Yeah. So the combat boots we had in Vietnam, I don't know if you guys ever seen them, but they were designed to let your feet breathe well. But you know what that means? That you don't have full leather around your feet. So when you're walking in the jungle and they've sprayed that herbicide, guess what happens?
Oh, my God, you're exposed.
It gets absorbed. I mean, while your feet are breathing, they're also taking up that chemical. So this thing has created this peripheral neuropathy in me. I don't have the other etiological causes, which is like diabetes and stuff like that. But it's gotten it went from where I could take an Advil or two before going to bed to stop the tingling enough to go to sleep. It would take maybe 30 minutes for the Advil to kick in. Now, this last 3 months, I take 6 200 milligram Advil. I take a half a tramadol. I take a gabapentin or two, and I still can't get to sleep. That's how much discomfort I've had. And when I can't get to sleep, I mean the witching hours from 11 till 3 or 4 a.m. So I fall asleep at 3 o'clock. I'm up at 7 usually, or 4, and I'm up at 7. I've been getting 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night for a long time. And I have been just fried, man. I mean, fried. I mean, I got patients saying, hey, you know, that was a pretty good session last time, except for when you fell asleep.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I mean, I say, oh, God, I'm so sorry. And I have to explain it. And I don't charge people for that, obviously, if that happens. I mean, it's a terrible thing that I've been going through. So I was finally encouraged and followed through to go to a neurologist. And I saw a neurologist on Friday. It was a Friday morning. And he went through my whole history and stuff like that. He says, well, look at your peripheral neuropathy. In addition to it creating all the problems in the pain in your feet, you also have restless leg syndrome that you can't lay still for a minute. It's caused by this thing. And he says, medicine you've been taking, the gabapentin, that used to be our first line of attack when somebody had a problem like this. But what we realized was that the absorption rate of the gabapentin is unpredictable. I can give you 600 milligrams of gabapentin, your body might only take 100 milligrams. So it's not going to give you the relief that you would hope you'd get from higher doses. Mm-hmm. He says, what we're going to do is change you over to Lyrica, which is an anticonvulsant medication, mm-hmm. right? Well, I took my first Lyrica on Friday night. What is today? Today's Sunday morning. The last two nights, I've been almost pain-free. I'm going to cry.
Wow.
I can't tell you what it's meant, man. It's like it's like a miracle to be sitting here and not in pain.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I didn't realize what it was doing to me.
Yeah, you can't afford to let all those feelings out until you're a little, you feel safe, you know, and on the other side of some of that. I'm so happy for you.
It's so good, but, you know, the side effect is I get a little dizzy, but I think that'll, he says that after a while and you adjust to the medication, that symptom should go away at some point in time. But I only took 200 milligrams yesterday, and I had a fucking pain-free day.
Wow.
It's like unbelievable, man. It's like,
thank God.
And that's why we tell people with looking health, keep looking. Don't assume that if you're not getting the help you need, it's not being mean to the doctor. You're not going to hurt anybody's feet. You just keep looking because that's the way we find the help we need.
That's so true, man. So true. It's so true.
I'm so glad you found this guy. Yeah.
Oh man, I'm so grateful. I mean, I'm sitting here so grateful now, and you know, some other great things have lined up. I went to the VA Medical Center now, and I'm registered, and all my medical care from this point on is covered by the Veterans Administration. So divorce doesn't mean anything. It doesn't change. In fact, it's going to be a better insurance for me than the one I got now.
Wow.
Okay. So, and that's because I'm 90% disabled from Vietnam.
Yeah. I remember your realization of that happened in real time on this podcast.
Yeah, I do too.
You're there talking about PTSD to people who have come back from Vietnam and how difficult it is for you guys. And, you know, there's things you can do about it. And someone says, you know, how about you, Alan? Huh? What? Who?
You know, and we don't see that. I mean, I was having an interaction with Maddie, and I'll go into details of that later at some day. And we have this wonderful person in our life named Gail, who's been a babysitter and has just been incredible during this divorce and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And Maddie was talking to me, and Gail said, you know, Alan, you just dismissed her feelings. It's so cool. And I go, you know what? God, I sure did. Maddie, I sure did. I'm so sorry. And that's that feedback. You know, we can help each other be better people. You really can, man. That gets back to this thing that Joe was talking about, community. Mm-hmm. And that's how we can start right in our own family, man. It starts right in our own family and our relationships. Tom, you've done that to me many times during this crisis, you know, and I hope that you felt the same way. Like when I sent you the text and stuff like that, how much I love you
and absolutely.
How worried I was about you. Mm-hmm. You had that answer and it going through.
No.
And the need of that kind of feedback, which can only come from community, like a partner. It could be like a romantic life partner, a mentor, you know, sponsee, any of these things, where the purpose isn't to make me feel better. The purpose is to feed back, you know, what their experience is of me, which I am blind to, right? Like, I think I'm ABC, they see me as DEF, right? You know, and they're not completely right and I'm completely wrong, but they have a different perspective that if I am open to it, it can help me see myself in another way, right? And and my state, so they can call me out on my state. What you talked about being pain-free, I had the experience of with realizing that I went through this long, long period of grief that where my homeostasis was sad, where when I was in a period of joyfulness, it was exhausting because I was outside of my normal comfort zone, right? It was like, and when you were talking, Alan, about not even knowing what a day pain-free looked like, right? Like I didn't know what a day of happy, you know, beginning to end looked like, right? You know, that was like this unfamiliar thing to me that exhausted me, right? And it's amazing. We need each other. We need feedback to sort of recalibrate, you know, if we can be open to somebody else's, you know, loving appraisal or, you know, to really sincerely ask them, what is your experience of me? What have I done that has you feeling this way? You know, just to sort of wrap the bow on that part of it.
One last thing before we wrap is 53 years, right, Alan?
Friday was 53 years clean and sober.
Amazing. So dry, you're a fire hazard.
Yeah. That's true. I'm ready to combust at any moment.
Maybe I'm not getting all this right, but that seems like a pretty long time.
Hey, and Alan, thank you for suiting up and showing up this podcast, for the workshops, for the meetings, for therapy. We really love you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this podcast, what makes it so different than so many is people aren't, I can't participate today. I'm not on, right? They just sort of bring it, right?
You know? We just show up.
Just show up.
That's the thing. The level of authenticity here is, I think, if people want to know an example or have an example of emotional sobriety, that's it. Because we show, just like you're saying, Joe, we show up as we are, trust that the process is going to unfold.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.